content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Welding Won't Make You Rich, by Paul Toef. A few years ago, a strange phenomenon began to appear in polls that asked Americans for their opinions about higher education. People's responses suddenly started to diverge along partisan lines. Democrats have continued to describe higher education as a mostly positive force in American life, but Republicans' opinions of college, beginning around 2015, took a sharp turn toward the negative. This shift didn't come out of nowhere. Conservative politicians and media figures have in recent years been making a sustained and often vociferous public case against higher education. Instead of college, their argument often goes, young Americans should pursue a career in the skilled trades. And there is one trade that gets held up more than any other as an example of the opportunities awaiting those who shun college: welding. If you trace back the history of this idea, you eventually get to a kind of welding text, an April 2014 op-ed column in the Wall Street Journal by Josh Mendel, then a Republican treasurer of Ohio, entitled, "Welders Make $150,000 a Year? Bring Back Shop Class." Its premise was that in rural Ohio, there was such a shortage of skilled tradespeople that employers were regularly hiring welders at salaries of $150,000 a year and up. Mandel contrasted the bountiful opportunities available to blue-collar workers without college degrees with the dismal prospects, he said, many college graduates faced. Too many young people have four-year liberal arts degrees, are thousands of dollars in debt, and find themselves serving coffee at Starbucks or working part-time at the mall. Mandel's notion of economic salvation through welding quickly spread from op-ed pages to cable news segments to political speeches. In 2015, in a presidential debate, Senator Marco Rubio declared, "For the life of me, I don't know why we have stigmatized vocational education. Welders make more money than philosophers. We need more welders and less philosophers." President Donald Trump invited a welder from Dayton to be one of the guests of honor at his first State of the Union address, and Secretary of Education Betty DeVos has visited welding classes across the country, from a suburb of Fort Worth to Far Rockaway, Queens. Paul Ryan extolled the virtues of a welding career at a summit meeting sponsored by the American Enterprise Institute. Even Ivanka Trump pulled on a welding mask for the cameras and tried her hand with a torch. In November of 2016, a few days after Donald Trump's victory, I traveled to Taylorsville, North Carolina, a small town in the Appalachian foothills. Taylorsville is remote and sparsely populated. To get to a Starbucks or a movie theater, or just a town with more than 5,000 people, it's at least a half-hour drive. Almost everyone in town is white, and only about 1 in 7 adults has a bachelor's degree. In the 2016 presidential election, 3/4 of the county voted Republican. I had come to Taylorsville to try to understand more deeply the relationship between higher education, opportunity, and welding, and I spent a couple of evenings in the home of a young welding student in his mid-20s named Ori Carrier, drinking coffee and talking. His journey through adolescence and high school had been rocky, he told me. Ori's father had left before he was born, and the absence of a stable male role model in his life had led him to some wild and self-destructive behavior, especially in his early teens. He made it through high school, but only barely, graduating 388th in a class of 389. After high school, Ori went to work. He spent a year installing locks for a local company, then another year doing oil changes at the Taylorsville Snappy Lube. Those jobs paid minimum wage or a little more, and the work wasn't steady or predictable. At 21, Ori got married, and he and his wife moved into a rented trailer. His stepfather helped him get his next job, drawing wire at a factory. It was hard work, loud and dirty and repetitive, but it paid $13.90 an hour, more than Snappy Lube. After a year and a half, Ori was fired for missing too many days of work, but he soon managed to land a job at another steel wire factory. Then he got fired from that job as well. It was by that point in the spring of 2016, and Ori was 24, separated, and unemployed. He was raising two children with his ex-wife, Katie, and he was living with a new girlfriend named Crystal. Ori had been working hard for 5 years, and yet he was broke, with nothing saved. At every job he'd had, he told me, he'd been made to feel as though he was disposable, like he didn't really matter. Crystal was also unemployed that spring, and she suggested they both think about going back to school. At first, college seemed like the last thing Ori might want to consider. But Crystal showed Ori the website for Catawba Valley Community College in nearby Hickory, and he saw that the school offered an associate's degree in welding. He'd done a little welding in high school and liked it, and that made the notion of college a lot easier to imagine. It dawned on me that by firing me, they had given me an opportunity, Ori told me, talking about his former employer. I could go to college to better myself, and I could find a different job, something that was away from all this. When I met Ori that November night in Taylorsville, he was just a couple of months into his first semester at CVCC. To his surprise, he had come to see college as a route to a better life, not just for himself, but for his young family. I wanted my kids to have stuff I didn't have growing up, he told me. I don't want them to have to wonder where their next meal is coming from. I want them to have the chances I never had. One of the many odd things about the rhetoric that posits welding as the antithesis of college is that in order to become a welder, you actually have to go to college. You can learn the basics in a high school shop class, as Ori did, but to do it well, you not only have to master multiple precise manual skills, you also need a pretty deep scientific understanding of the metal you're working with and the electrical and chemical processes you're using to manipulate that metal. To earn an associate's degree, Ori would need to pass 12 separate welding courses, plus basic courses in math and English, as well as more conceptual courses in welding metallurgy. His first year at CVCC went well, mostly. It wasn't completely smooth. He failed his required English course, which was only offered online. But in his welding class, he earned nothing but A's and B's. After that first year ended, he ran into some bureaucratic trouble with his financial aid, he told me, and he took both the summer and the fall of 2017 off from school. For a while, I wondered whether he might just be finished with college. But then he started up again as a full-time student in January of 2018. When I visited him that winter, Ori said he was glad to be back in school, but otherwise life was not going well. He and Crystal were broke. They had been evicted from their house, and their car was stolen. There was a moment that semester, Ori told me, when he wanted to give up on school, leave his family behind, and start over in a new town. But he kept thinking of his children and the example he was setting for them. He decided to get back to class, even if he had to take the bus many miles to get there. Still, at the end of that semester, Ori remained 16 credits shy of the 65 he needed to complete his associate's degree, and those included his required English and math classes, which he wasn't confident he could pass. Part of him wanted to go right back to school in the fall and finish his degree, but he wasn't sure how to pull it off. He and Crystal had broken up, and he was back together with his ex-wife, Katie. Ori and Katie and their two kids had moved in with Ori's mother. That summer, he found a job in Wilkesboro, working in a factory that manufactured doors. It was a good position, but the work was hot and exhausting, and his schedule was brutal. 12-hour night shifts for 7 days straight, from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., followed by 7 straight days off. He knew there was no way he could manage school with that schedule. He was earning $16.75 an hour, which was a decent wage, but it was only a couple of dollars an hour more than he had been making before he started college. And now he had $19,000 in student loans that he would soon have to start paying back. Ori was no longer feeling all that optimistic about the welding profession. Despite the sunny claims of the Wall Street Journal and Marco Rubio, the real-life welding jobs that Ori was able to find in Western North Carolina were paying experienced welders between $12 and $15 an hour, which was less than he was making at the door factory. Ori knew that better-paying welding jobs existed, but they were far away and short-term and physically arduous, and if he went out and chased one, he'd have to leave his kids behind. Now that he was back together with Katie and they had what felt like a genuine family, he wanted to stay close to home and be a real father. Besides, even those well-paying welding jobs didn't pay that well, maybe $30 or $40 an hour if he got lucky. This is the other glaring flaw at the heart of the case for welding as the ideal alternative to college. The overwhelming majority of American welders are not earning $150,000 a year, not even close. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average annual salary for an experienced welder in 2018 was a little more than $41,000 a year, which was only about $16,000 above the poverty line for a family of four. The good thing about welding as a profession is that it has a relatively high salary floor. You're almost always going to make more than minimum wage, even starting out. But the downside economically is that welding has a pretty low salary ceiling. Welders at the 90th percentile of income for the profession, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, earn $63,000 a year before taxes. Those are statistically the top earners, and they are usually expert welders with decades of experience. The salaries that they make the headlines in the Wall Street Journal are somewhere between rare and apocryphal. Which leads to an intriguing question. Given the sobering reality that those unbiased statistics convey, why has the wealthy welder myth become so widely accepted, at least in certain circles? Why does Marco Rubio believe, or claim to believe, that welders make more than philosophers? Let me suggest three possible reasons. The first and most obvious one is that the people making the political speeches and writing the newspaper columns and taking part in the cable news segments don't know any actual welders. When you watch talk show conversation about the folly of the 4-year college degree, you can be reasonably confident that everyone on camera has a 4-year college degree. So this is potential reason number one, simple ignorance. The second possible reason is wishful thinking, topped with a dollop of nostalgia. Money aside, welding is an impressive and admirable pursuit. It is a burly, physical job, and there is a delicate artistry in it as well, fine craftsmanship with a creative spirit. And in an economy in which manual labor could reliably earn enough money to support a middle-class family, which is to say an economy like the United States had not too long ago, would indeed be more equitable, more socially stable, and more family-friendly than the actual economy we have today. The third possible reason for the ubiquity of the wealthy welder myth is less benign. If we are able to persuade ourselves that there are plenty of lucrative opportunities available for young people like Ori, who didn't much like high school, it absolves us of our shared responsibility to address the reality of his limited economic prospects. And if you are able to define welding training in the public mind as something separate from college rather than what it actually is, a college major like any other, it provides a way to distract public attention from policy shifts that have made it more difficult for young people like Ori to reach the middle class. Over the past decade, as the make-believe story of the rich welder has grown and spread, public spending on the community colleges where actual young people are trying to learn actual welding has shrunk, in some states, quite drastically so. In North Carolina, the amount the state government spends on each community college student declined, after adjusting for inflation, from $5,830 per student in 2007 to $4,891 per student in 2016, the year that Ori enrolled in Catawba Valley Community College. That's a cut of about 16%, and it took place during a period when state tax revenues in North Carolina actually went up. The state has the money, in other words, but state legislators are choosing not to spend it on institutions like CVCC. What happened in North Carolina mirrors what happened in most other states. When the recession hit in 2008, tax revenues dropped sharply, and state governments cut their spending on higher education. Then the recovery arrived, and tax revenues went back up, but most state governments didn't replace the funding they had cut from the budgets of community colleges and other public colleges. Those budget cuts in North Carolina had a direct impact on Ori's experience at CVCC. First, they added to his tuition costs and thus to his debt. When adjusted for inflation, community college tuition in North Carolina has increased by 49% since 2007. But more important, the new revenue from North Carolina's community college students has not been enough to compensate for the cuts in state spending, which means that colleges have had to cut budgets and cut corners. That is why the English class that Ori needs to pass in order to get his degree is offered only online, because it's cheaper that way. There is no doubt that Ori would benefit from high-quality, face-to-face instruction from a caring and conscientious English professor, but he is almost certainly not going to get it, and that is going to make it much harder for him to pass and thus to graduate. Ori says he is still determined to finish his associate's degree, but if he doesn't manage to do so, he won't be alone. Right now, only 26% of students at CVCC are able to complete a two-year degree in 3 years. Second, A Fake Yellow Line Changed Football Forever, by Jacob Stern. Football is a complicated sport. Offensive players can move around before the quarterback calls hike, but only certain ones at certain times in certain directions. A defender can rough up a receiver within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, but only if he remains in front of the receiver and the contact is continuous. After that, the defender can still make some contact, but only as long as it does not significantly hinder the receiver from catching the ball, whatever you interpret that to mean. And that's without getting into what constitutes a catch, a seemingly basic question that the NFL rulebook turns into a matter of great metaphysical complexity. At least one thing in football is not complicated. That is, if you're watching on TV. The yellow first down marker. The virtual line convincingly projected onto the field during every major football telecast through augmented reality makes the sport immediately more digestible. Football, as the cliché goes, is a game of inches, and even the most diehard fans benefit from the clarity and drama that the yellow marker provides. For the uninitiated, it's a lifeline. What's going on? Well, one team is trying to get the ball to the yellow line. The other is trying to stop them. Simple. The yellow line is refreshingly straightforward, uncomplicatedly great, and massively influential. Each week during the football season, hundreds of millions of viewers tune in to see it. So integral has the yellow line become to the experience of watching football that most of them probably no longer even pay much attention to it. Not only has the yellow line revolutionized the experience of watching football, it can quite possibly be understood as the grandfather of the new Apple Vision Pro and other such goggles. The first down marker was one of the first kinds of augmented reality technology that spectators ever encountered, and to this day is perhaps the most widely viewed of it use of it ever. The technology behind the line did not have an auspicious beginning. In 1994, Fox, which had just acquired the rights to broadcast the National Hockey League, wanted a way to make the puck more visible to TV viewers, and so a team within the company designed a system that would make the puck appear to glow blue. When its speed broke 70 miles an hour, the glow would turn red, and a comet tail would appear. Fox hailed the glowing puck as the greatest technological breakthrough in the history of sports, but hockey fans rejected it as gimmicky distraction. David Letterman mocked it in a skit on which a glowing blue dot circled his head. In 1998, Fox scrapped that glowing puck. The same year, though, the team responsible for the glowing puck broke off to found its own company, Sport Vision, and introduced the virtual yellow first down line. It was a near-instant success. Chad Gobert, a professor at Kennesaw State University who studies augmented reality in sports, told me, "Simple and unobtrusive, its utility self-evident. The yellow marker system effectively turned the field into a green screen so that the line would appear on top of the grass, but not on top of the players when they passed over it, and remained fixed as the camera moved around. The technology earned Sport Vision an Emmy, the first of 10 the company would go on to win. When Fox tried to drop the yellow line from its broadcast in 2001, fans revolted. "I need the line," one fan wrote on the site that Sport Vision set up to gather viewer input. "Everybody needs the line." Another fan called it the best thing you came up with since color TV. 26 years after the yellow line delivered augmented reality to the masses, it looks basically the same now as it did then. Many broadcasts have added the line of scrimmage in blue, or a line indicated the edge of the field goal range in green, but the yellow line remains. If anything, football has become nearly unthinkable without it. Gobert has heard of fans showing up to their first in-person football game and discovering, to their surprise, that the yellow line isn't real. The yellow line that spawned the whole lineage of so-called digital overlays in other sports have come to seem about as normal as the original one. Pretty much every broadcast of Major League Baseball these days includes a virtual strike zone. Golf broadcasts use augmented reality to display the ball's flight path. On NBC's Olympic swimming telecast, a virtual world record line allows you to track how a swimmer is faring against not just their immediate competitors, but against the all-time mark. Other overlay uses have met with more lukewarm reception. All sorts of broadcasts now use augmented reality to superimpose real-looking advertisements onto courts and fields. The Los Angeles Clippers and a company called Second Spectrum pioneered a system that, among other things, dramatized three-pointers with lightning bolts and defense with actual fences. The digital overlays have caught on, though, are the ones that learned the lessons from the glowing puck and the first down line, Gobert told me. Whereas the glowing puck made the telecast look like a video game, the first down line looked as though it were painted onto the field, same as the other lines. It became a part of reality. The virtual strike zone, the golf ball flight path, and the swimming world record line don't quite blur into reality the way the first down line does, but they are similarly rendered visible things that viewers are already trying to imagine. These overlays are like the astronomy apps that highlight constellations when you point your phone at the night sky. They augment reality rather than dilute it with fantasy. They provide information that most people seem to want in a way that is relatively unobtrusive to those who don't. They're complementary to what's going on rather than distracting from what's going on, Gobert said. Now, however, much of the point of augmented reality is to distract you from reality, not to blend into it. In Pokemon Go, one of the most popular AR games of the past decade, the digital overlays are the main event. Football broadcasts, empowered by the fact that not everyone has to watch the same one anymore, have also taken this principle to heart. In recent years, the NFL has aired games on Nickelodeon in which the end zone is turned into the slime zone. This season, the league introduced the Toy Story Fun Day football game, in which an entirely animated version of a matchup between the Atlanta Falcons and the Jacksonville Jaguars was played in Andy's room with Buzz and Woody looking on. Slinky Dog served as the first down marker. This weekend, Nickelodeon will air its first live Super Bowl telecast with SpongeBob SquarePants serving as the announcer. The future is generally going to revolve around choice, Gobert told me. People are almost always going to be able to choose their own adventure, as far as the viewing modes go. And they'll have the yellow first down line to thank for it. The ultimate irony of the line is that it made for a world without customization, and yet it made possible a world of infinite customization. It succeeded because it was perfectly calibrated to an era in which everyone watched one broadcast. But it helped inaugurate one in which everyone can watch their own broadcast. Now the Vision Pro will take things a step further. It will fragment our experience of actual life. In the same way that the NFL offers multiple ways to watch a game, the Vision Pro and other AR headsets will offer multiple ways to see the world. Millions of people will turn on the Super Bowl and see the yellow line projected onto the field, whether on their TV or through the Vision Pro strapped to their head. Next, anchovies are a force to be reckoned with, by Christina Couch. The Ito Fernandez Castro wasn't looking to find a turbulent hotbed of anchovy sex. Commissioned by the Spanish government to investigate the conditions behind algae blooms, which kills mussels, Castro and his team were studying a peaceful spot in a bay in northwestern Spain. In the absence of strong winds or waves, toxic algae blooms occurred more frequently here compared with surrounding areas, to the detriment of the resident mussels and mussel farmers. But after 2 weeks of monitoring the apparently tranquil waters with sensors that measure small shifts in temperature and velocity, Castro and his colleagues found that the bay's calm surface belied what was happening below. Every night and without apparent reason, we were seeing very, very high levels of turbulence, says Castro, a physical oceanographer with England's University of Southampton. Castro and his colleagues eventually traced the source of all this mixing, the frothing free-for-all of an anchovy orgy. These fish churn the water as much as a major storm does. Turbulence is crucial for mixing heat and nutrients throughout the ocean. Previous research largely shows that the turbulent animals cause living their lives. Generally, the turbulence isn't enough to substantially mix the layers of the ocean's water columns. In general, winds, tides, and forceful currents are the main things that stir and mix the ocean. Kirsten Schultz, a physical oceanographer at the University of Texas at Austin, says scientists don't typically consider animal movement to be a major cause of mixing in the ocean as a whole. However, researchers have a lot to learn about how tiny turbulent motions mix ocean layers of different densities, salinities, and chemical makeups in shallow bays and other water bodies. Although much more research is needed to fully understand ocean mixing and the role that marine animals might play in the process, Castro's accidental anchovy discovery shows there's more to the sultry lives of sea animal creatures than we surface dwellers may think. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.